This is John DeVille, the mountain philosopher. A few months back, I had the pleasure of sitting around a campfire with former students Canyon and Forrest Woodward, and they prodded me to do a podcast. We noodled about for the evening as to what the content, what the focus might be, and we didn't really land on anything. And Forrest thought that that was just fine. "Who's going to listen?" I asked. "Five people?" Forrest argued that quite possibly popularity had an inverse relationship to quality. I love the sentiment as much as I do the out. I'm still not sure about the content and what the focus of the podcast are going to be. I'm saying it's about history, politics, philosophy, and the metaphysical. And here we are with the first episode, which is certainly about history, but more specifically, it's a lesson in a box that someone else, Lily Vitale, designed and delivered. The quest for clarity continues. A bit on the confused and confusing branding. Mountain Philosopher is the name of the podcast, and all the content can be found at mountainphilosopher.org. TheSocialStudies.org is my classroom website and has been for over 10 years. So there you can find history, civics, and philosophy content I've delivered over the years to high school students, as well as for my adult classes in history and philosophy. And Komodo Dragon Production will be any Mountain Philosopher content that is co-produced with my friend and colleague, Lily Vitale. A few months ago, Lily sent me this insanely cute YouTube video with a kid named Dylan, who was featured on Julian Shapiro Barnum's YouTube channel, Recess Therapy, where Julian interviews young children and shares their sense of wonder and joy. Dylan, talking about his favorite animal, the Komodo dragon, went viral to the tune of 3 million plus views. Not sure how old Dylan is, and that's not important. What is important is that Dylan can see the magic. Dylan can be magic. He can live in magic. And that's what childhood can give us, a sense of magic. And not in some purely mental state, but an experiential state. Children can intermittently live in magical worlds. In that sense, that capacity to experience magic is programmed away from us because it doesn't serve dominant economic and cultural systems, its profiteers and masters. Most of us succumb most of the time to the programming. But Dylan, seeing the magic of the Komodo dragon, he restores the mythical Tua dragon, a creature that we come to learn that he believes can, quote-unquote, eat a people. Dylan brings us into the magical, courtesy of the interviewer Julian Shapiro Barnum. Julian seamlessly enters Dylan's magical world and then in turn invites us in. That's the joy and hope that can be found in the magical. Our topic for the first episode is eugenics, the dark side of American progressivism. And while there certainly isn't enjoying the topic, perhaps we can find some hope in the fact that when the students came face to face with the documents, they demonstrated tremendous empathy. We saw that their hearts were hardened and remained a dwelling place for the magical and the transformative. Perhaps it's the power of the Blue Ridge Mountains. All the show notes you need for the lesson can be found at mountainphilosopher.org. I hope you enjoyed the show, and Lily and I would love to hear how the lesson went in your classroom. You can reach us at mountainphilosopherpodcast@gmail.com. And now, on to the show. Welcome to the Mountain Philosopher. On today's episode of The Mountain Philosopher, eugenics, the dark side of American progressivism. This episode is produced in conjunction with thesocialstudies.org. This is a Komodo dragon production.
Really like Komodo dragons.
Well, this is episode one of The Mountain Philosopher, a podcast that delves into spirituality, American culture, politics, education, philosophy. And we don't really know what we're doing, but this is episode one, and we're going to give it a shot here. And I'm fortunate to be joined here on St. Patrick's Day with my friend and my co-teacher, Lily Vitale. Lily, welcome to Mountain Philosopher.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Lily developed this incredible lesson on eugenics, put hours into creating the lesson, curated tons of primary source documents, put a lot of thought into it, created a set of questions that goes along with the primary source documents, and then delivered the lesson here in class a few weeks ago. And it went over very well. And I think the students really got a lot out of the lesson. And after doing the lesson and wanting to do some sort of a podcast, we talked about putting the lesson into the podcast. And so if you're a classroom teacher here in North Carolina or anywhere in the United States and you want to do a lesson on eugenics, then you've tuned into the right podcast, because in the show notes, we will have all the primary source documents that you need to print out or push out in your Google Classroom for the lesson, along with the guided questions that Lily developed for the students. And you can take this lesson very easily and push it out there. So this is kind of like a Blue Apron episode right here, where you can listen about the topic and kind of get a handle on the primary source documents on your way into work or after school one afternoon, and you can turn around and deliver the lesson the next day. The lesson is designed to be executed in a single 90-minute block, but you can divvy it up or, you know, cut it or add to it however you wish, whatever works for you in your classroom. But we're going to go ahead and do a deep dive here into eugenics.
Deep dive.
And it's a good one.
So we've got Lily here to walk us through this lesson and walk us through eugenics. Let me start off with just a basic question here. What the heck is eugenics?
Well, I would say it's just the categorization of people that don't offer any benefits of capital. They don't offer people wealth. They don't offer them social capital. And so they're not deemed important in society. And we want to remove their ability to be involved or included in society. We want to ostracize them from society, whether we sterilize them, institutionalize them, or however that's deemed possible.
Okay, so there's obviously a racist component to eugenics. And when we talked about this, and when you delivered the lesson, you divvied up eugenics into what, as near as I can tell, into five separate categories. You talked about the justification for eugenics. Mm-hmm. You talked about how institutionalization promoted the goals of eugenics. You talked about how marriage and racial purity laws promoted the goals of eugenics. You talked about the immigration restrictions that the United States puts into place in the 1920s and how that furthers the aims of eugenics. And then finally, you talked about sterilization. So when I think about eugenics and taught it in the classroom for over two decades, I only think about sterilization. So let's go ahead and talk about the justification. And you came across an anthropologist, and we were talking about this earlier in doing the show prep. This anthropologist actually kidnapped another human being and brought that human being to the United States for the 1904 World's Fair. Do I have the facts right on that?
Multiple human beings, but we cover one named Otabanga. Before we get right into Otabanga, my case with doing the five stations was putting a human being at the forefront of each of these stations. So when we go to the justification station, that's where we meet Otabanga. So now we can talk about who Samuel Verner is. Well, Samuel Verner was a missionary He retired from doing missionary work, and then he went into anthropology. Well, anthropology at the time was interested in the categorization of human beings into savages and primates, into studying cranial differences and categorization. So Samuel Verner goes to the Congo. He is looking for African artifacts. He becomes a broker of African artifacts, but he also becomes a broker of Africans. He buys Africans from African slave traders to bring to the 1904 World's Fair. So he buys, I believe, 12 Africans, including Ota, brings them back to the 1904 World's Fair, where Ota is recognized by the director of the Bronx Zoo. And the director of the Bronx Zoo says, hey, this is bringing a lot of attention. I think we should put Ota in a cage. And I think people would be fascinated to study this primitive man, this primitive species. It wasn't even a man. It was a specimen. That's how they referred to Ota, as a specimen. And so they did. They put Ota in a cage with the apes. And hundreds of people came through the Bronx Zoo for that week-long exhibition to view Ota. And there were African-American clergymen who said, you know, this man in a cage, this 23-year-old man has a soul. You don't deserve to put him in a cage. He's a human being. And so there was a pushback. There was also a pushback from Christians who said, you know, you're supporting Darwinism because you're putting this man in a cage with monkeys. So you're drawing a connection. And so there was an outcry there as well.
Well, that's kind of interesting that there was, so I want to make sure I understand you right. There's an anti-evolution Christian contingent that is opposed to Ota being put on display because they think that putting Ota on display furthers the beliefs, the idea of Darwin.
Man and monkey, yeah. So showing Ota's behaviors alongside the apes is just furthering that idea.
And of course, in a twisted way, of course, you know, they're right because, you know, it wasn't really Darwin that I don't think is, you know, is animating the goals and the aims of the anthropologist or the Bronx Zoo or ultimately the World's Fair, but social Darwinism, this notion that there's such a thing as racial or ethnic supremacy and that, you know, wealthy people are somehow genetically superior to those who are poor. You know, the ideas that are animating social Darwinism that is impacting American policy both domestically and certainly informing, justifying a lot of our imperial acts. So how does Ota get from the Bronx Zoo to the World's Fair?
Well, he goes opposite way.
Okay.
So he goes from the World's Fair to the Bronx Zoo.
Okay.
1904 to 1906 is when he's in the Bronx Zoo.
And you included Ota in this story, and again, under this category of justification. Is it just that there were things like this happening in the country at the time, or that are going to go on, that are basically kind of putting out this general narrative of white supremacy, of racial categories, of racial hierarchy that are going to go on later to be used as justification for eugenics? Or is there a direct connection, or is it more of an indirect connection?
In the primary source documents, we show the students a tree guide that has different, you know, skulls. And so these skulls were supposed to represent different populations around the world. Of course, this is pseudoscience, this is not real, but it was to show that, you know, Anglo-Saxon skulls are at the tippity top of this tree, and that's what we should be aiming for. And so these people were being used to show that we can do better as a society and move upwards.
So I'm curious, you know, before we move on past the World's Fair and the Bronx Zoo and Ota being used as a sideshow and justification for future eugenic actions and policies, Do you happen to know what happened to Oda?
Yeah, so before Oda came to America, before he was captured by African slave traders, his whole family was massacred. His whole village was massacred under the order of King Leopold II. And because of this, you know, Oda was out on a hunt. So when he had come back from the hunt, he was sold to African slave traders and then exchanged hands to Samuel Verner, and then he got to America. So about 10 years pass after the incident at the Bronx Zoo, and I think he gets factory work, if I remember reading correctly. Well, Ota builds a ceremonial fire, and he takes off the caps on his teeth that were placed there by Samuel Verner. His teeth were shaved down ceremonially in his village, and they were capped so they wouldn't scare the patrons. So he takes those caps off and he shoots himself in the heart. I think he was in his early 30s.
Man, what a story. What I want to do right now, Lily, is I want to share with our listeners you interacting with the students here on Station One, which specifically dealt with Ota.
What question did you have about the chart here?
On the last one?
Yeah.
It says, how can the viewer about the predominant progressive area understand of race?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, all of them are kind of the same? Or, because I mean, it has like the same color black, so I mean, I don't know if that...
Right, so what are all of these skulls resting on?
A tree.
Okay, so it's growing upward, right? So at the time, scientists believe that the top of this tree is superior. This is the height of the human race. This is as high as high up intelligence-wise as it goes. These are the people that should be reproducing. Okay, so you also have... You're okay. I'm just trying to see. You also have different skull shapes as well, which was used by early anthropologists to determine, you know, who was intellectually fit to be reproducing as well. So think about, you know, Caucasian. You have where white people are on there, where Chinese people, where Australian, and then how they label this, okay?
So since, like, he was in with the origin...
Right, he was in with an orangutan.
Yeah, so, like, they thought of him as, like the lowest, kind of. Yeah. So, like, oh, okay.
Yeah, and where did he come from?
He was taken away from his home.
Oh. Yeah, where was his home?
The called...
Congolese,
yeah, so he was from the Congo. He was from Africa.
The Congo.
Yeah. And he was from an indigenous group in that area. So, does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
Where they view him? Okay.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Okay, let's see. What else? Okay, also at this one, pay attention how the people are reacting. I highlighted some of the areas, but there's a mixture of response. And note who is responding to what, who is disapproving, who is approving, emotions.
So we're moving on to institutionalization. If you could talk to the folks here about how institutionalization played into the whole scheme of eugenics.
So here we meet a young woman named Emma Wolverton, who also has the name Deborah Kallikak in the history books. But we call her Emma in class, and she was a woman who was institutionalized because of her family's poverty, because of her interests, because of her bloodline. And all of these factors put her in a woman's working home. And she spent her whole life there. I believe she died in her 80s, and she had lived there that entire time.
And why she put in the home?
She was put in the home for multiple reasons. Some scientists, progressive scientists, had come in early and started testing her. They said she was feeble-minded and that she needed to be put into this home. There was also a myth that her American patriot great-grandfather, you know, slept with a tavern woman, and she's a descendant of that tavern woman, and so her blood is tainted, and, you know, that's where the feeble-mindedness comes from. But she was really just from a poor family. And, you know, Emma's teachers were interviewed, and we read some of that interview, and she's actually a really bright young woman who was incredibly kind and really involved, and she would look after the children of her teachers, and she was a great part of her community.
Well, it seems to me like you could argue that putting her in an institution was an act of kindness if she's feeble-minded. I mean, why was this a bad thing?
That justification took away her humanity. She didn't get a choice to live outside of the institution. She didn't get a choice to not take care of other kids. She didn't get a choice to have her own kids to take care of, if that's what she chose to do.
Well, let me interrupt you. Based on what you read about this woman, would she have been able to take care of herself? Would she have been able to raise children?
I don't think that's anybody's call. But I would say that from my views, not that it matters, that she was very well equipped to do so. She was taking care of her school teacher's children, and they loved playing with her, and she would put on plays, and she would make their costumes and their props, and she had great energy. And, you know, I'm not a mother myself, so I don't know the qualities of motherhood, but I think she was demonized for her family's role in the community and for
what was her family's role?
Her great grandfather, maybe, you know, cheating on her great grandmother, or his different interactions, or another family member's different interactions. This whole myth around her lineage that's passed on to her. She's totally undeserving of it, and it deprived her of humanity. And she still had such an amazing attitude. And the way that school teachers wrote about her and her community wrote about her when she passed away when she was 80, it's just beautiful, but it's still incredibly hard to see, because she was deprived of things that she shouldn't have been deprived of because of her class, I would argue.
Now, I'm going to make sure that I'm not straying too far off at all from the truth. Do I have it right that, you know, her surname is Kallikak, that this is part of the Kallikak family study that has so much notoriety in American history?
Yeah, Emma was one of the children. Emma Wolverton is her real name, but that was the pseudonym they picked
for this particular study about feeble-minded people. Yes. and the cost to cities of the so-called feeble-minded.
She was one of the family members.
Okay, so I want to go ahead and interject this part here, because I think it's a fascinating piece of history. And some of the listeners, especially teachers of American history, are all familiar with the Scopes trial, which is a debate that takes place in Dayton, Tennessee. It's either 1925 or 1926. And so there's the famous trial, which is really theater, with William Jennings Bryan and Clarence Darrow going at it over evolution. What tends to be left out of that story is the textbook that the students of Tennessee were using. In fact, it was the number one textbook in the United States at the time, and that was Hunter's Civic Biology. Now, I want the listeners to consider that we're taking biology and we're laying it alongside notion of civics. And so in that textbook is this Kallikak study. And the argument that is made in Hunter Civic Biology, that this one particular family cost the taxpayers thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars over the generations. And so there's an implicit argument that something must be done to stop these people from reproducing. And so you see it there, that social Darwinist argument in Hunter Civic Biology, and we can see that argument playing out in a more material form with Emma Wolverton being basically incarcerated in an institution because of who her grandparents and great grandparents were. Is that, do I have that right?
It was somewhere down the line, you know. But there was no proof that that's what even happened. It was a myth connected to her poverty.
Okay, so I want to go back into the classroom with you interacting with the students about Emma Wolverton.
Okay, how's it going?
Pretty good. My handwriting is horrible, but you know.
What are you thinking? What are you thinking about it so far?
About which, like, is specific part or just?
Well, Emma. Overall. Emma. Who she is as a person, how they're making her seem.
There wasn't really anything wrong with her, or not like significant, but they think from like her conditions and like how she grew up and like her genetics and stuff that she was like lesser than, or like
we are not.
So have you read yet about her parents? Okay, so what are her parents? Who are her parents?
Her mom was, I guess, her mom got dismissed when she was pregnant with her, and her dad was unknown, and I'm pretty sure she said her grandparents were also disabled. I think.
Okay.
Hang on just a second, okay?
Okay, so from that, we have this myth that comes up, this myth of Martin. What do we know about Martin?
I didn't read all of that yet.
Okay, I'll let you guys, I'll come back. I want to hear about Martin.
Okay, so station number 3 was about marriage and racial purity laws, and that was Virginia that you focused on?
Yes.
Okay. And so I just, you know, we're going to move, because I want to make sure we get down to sterilization, because I think when we think about eugenics and sterilization, so maybe we go through stations 3 and 4 here a little bit more quickly. Yeah. But when I say racial purity, we're talking about laws that are designed to prevent quote unquote miscegenation. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Okay, and that existed in Virginia, these anti-miscegenation laws, all the way up to the Loving case, which there's actually a recent movie about, and that's the 1960s, 1970s that these anti-miscegenation laws were still on the books.
I believe so. Yeah.
So, you know, again, you can go straight to the documents and you can take a look at the documents that deal with the racial purity laws of Virginia. But suffice it to say, it's another tool in the toolkit to maintain this perverse notion of racial supremacy and push the ideas of eugenics. We'll move on from there to immigration restrictions.
Can I add one little part?
Of course you can.
With the primary documents in that station as well, the students can really interact with how communities were split apart under these laws as well. So they really attach to that idea. So that's something a teacher could.
Well, and you know, when we did prep for this about a week and a half ago, and that was an idea that did strike me, that notions of race are not intrinsic. That they are imposed upon us. And if I understood what you said, and also what the students were reflecting back to you, is that the people in these quote unquote communities, and it was the students who actually used those term community.
Yeah,
that wasn't in the documents. They came up
in the documents and I didn't say it beforehand.
Which is very interesting to me that they're gravitating towards this notion that, you know, maybe is really the key to, you know, getting us out of our current polarized state is this notion of community. But The people who lived in these quote-unquote communities were of different ethnicities, of different racial backgrounds, right?
Right.
And they got along fine, right? And then here came the progressives with their categories and their public policy, and it's the categories and the public policy that shattered the cohesiveness of the community. Yeah, is that right?
They couldn't eat meals together anymore. They couldn't go to church services together anymore. And, you know, a student brought that up to me. They said, you know, that really ruins a community when you can't eat together. And I was shocked that they had brought that up. And I was really amazed that they did as well, because I thought that that was a really good point. And so I wanted to highlight that.
It's a poignant observation and also tragic. So the next station we've got is immigration restrictions. And again, my understanding of immigration restrictions, we have a Chinese Exclusion Act. There is the gentleman's agreement with Japan for them not to send us any more immigrants. But basically, you know, from the 1870s up to 1920, anybody who wanted to come to the United States, regardless of their ethnicity, regardless of their religious background, could come here. Is that that's your understanding?
Yeah.
Okay. But something happens here in the 1920s. And so I'm going to talk just a second, because I just happened to teach this in the unit in the 1920s, that we have these different waves of nativism that overtake us in American history. And one of those periods is the 1850s, and another one of those periods is the 1920s, the period immediately after World War I. And I can put it into the show notes. We dramatically curtail not just the number of immigrants that can come into the United States, but we heavily proscribe which ethnic group can come in. So Russian Jews, good luck getting into the United States after 1924. Polish Catholics, good luck getting into the United States after 1924. The only people that we have, like an unlimited number of folks who can come in after 1924, are Canadians and Mexicans. It's basically anybody from Latin America, but in 1924, we're primarily talking about Mexico. So cheap labor can come in. But again, the point, if we look at the contents of the Immigration Act in 1924, which is going to be the primary American immigration law until 1965. So it's a 41-year-old law. That's its lifespan. There are all these racial and racist components to that immigration law. Is there anything else in that particular station that you would like to add?
Nothing really too substantial. I would say that that station focuses on how workers at Ellis Island, doctors at Ellis Island in 1911, were really connected with the Eugenics Record Office and how this led to policy in the 1920s. So the primary documents show that as well.
Okay, so we're going to listen to you interacting with the students one last time here.
The first one?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you see it? Can you read it from here?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Okay, so this is the immigration station. So be thinking about federal policy. Okay, what individuals were able to do, how they were able to influence the Committee on Immigration and the U.S. Census Bureau. Think about that, okay? So those federal public health employees are in the first box of the top. So they were the ones doing the inspections at Ellis Island.
And they decided whether or not they were worthy of coming into the country based on...
Right.
Like if they thought they were inferior to... Yeah.
Inferior stock. Yeah. Okay, so it's like what we talked about in the beginning of class.
Yeah.
Okay. And so how were they able to influence policy, do you think?
Because they could pretty much choose it. If they thought that... They could have said that there was something wrong with them when there wasn't actually anything wrong with them. Just because they didn't want them coming into the country.
They didn't want them coming. Okay, that's a good point.
And that's exactly what ended up happening. I'll let you keep reading so you can get to the other questions. Okay.
All right, Lily, the our last station here and our last topic today is sterilization, which, again, is when I think about eugenics, that's what I think about. And I'll put in the show notes a lesson I put together specifically on sterilization here in North Carolina. But, again, you know, you kept turning over rocks and finding things that I never heard of in my life. And I'm going to give you three things here. Three proper nouns, and then you're going to tell us about sterilization. So we're going to talk about Clarence Gamble, who's the heir to the Procter & Gamble fortune, Margaret Sanger, who founds Planned Parenthood, and the American territory of Puerto Rico. Go.
So Dr. Clarence Gamble had a profound interest in eugenics and wanted to test out some new methods of birth control, new methods of sterilization, and he essentially used the women of Puerto Rico as guinea pigs. So him and Margaret Sanger went down to Puerto Rico, and at the end of their work down there, one third of Puerto Rican women were sterilized. I had never heard about this before. I had never heard about the birth control trials that they had run on the women down there, or any of the impacts, any of the feedback, any of the counter protest, really nothing.
How many people are we talking about being sterilized in Puerto Rico? A handful? 100? Any idea?
One third of the total population of women are still impacted by the actions today.
Okay, so it's 2022. We're talking about something that happened like a century ago. How could a third of the Puerto Rican women in 2022 be impacted by something that happened a century ago? Let's keep this simple here. What were Sanger and Gamble's goals? What were they trying to do in Puerto Rico? Why were they in Puerto Rico?
I would argue that they're trying to make birth control more accessible in America. So they were testing different options for birth control. And they're not going to test it on white women in America. So they're finding a different population where they can use them as guinea pigs. So they picked Puerto Rican women.
Okay, so I'll make sure I've got my facts straight. So it's not so much, did they do sterilization of Puerto Rican women?
They did sterilization as well, yes. But
okay, so it's a dual program. Yeah. There's a sterilization program, and then there's also we're going to use the Puerto Rican women as non-consensual, non-informed volunteers in lab experiments to test the efficacy and the safety of new birth control procedures. Do I have that right?
Yeah, and yes, and it was based off of the work that Gamble had been doing in North Carolina on sterilizations. So that's where it moves from North Carolina to Puerto Rico when they start testing these new birth controls. And there's some other actors involved as well, some other doctors. This is not just Clarence Gamble and Margaret Sanger, but those are two of the biggest names that I think people may recognize. And two that stood out to me as well. And two that stand out to me particularly because of how Planned Parenthood is lauded today. And I think there's a sacrifice there that Puerto Rican women did not give consent to be tested on, to have these birth control methods tested on them. And they paid for that. And because of that, today, women have access to these options and they can give consent to have these options. And the history books ignore them for the most part. And we remember women like Margaret Sanger instead of these Puerto Rican women.
So we should remember Margaret Sanger, but we also need to remember the women of Puerto Rico who... Go ahead.
I think we remember Margaret Sanger, but not in the light that she is remembered. I think we we put the spotlight on the Puerto Rican women who were not able to give consent. And we just stick with that.
That's fair enough. Anything else that you would like to add about the lesson as far as how it went over, or thoughts for anybody who is considering teaching this lesson in class?
I'll just say that I was nervous to teach certain things, like showing a young African man in a cage in, you know, a rural, predominantly white classroom. I didn't really know how that would come across. But I was blown away by the empathy, by the thoughtfulness, by the interactions, by the wonderful feedback. And I don't think these things go over their heads. I think they can be really connected with this information. And I think seeing a person, seeing Emma, seeing Ota, seeing the stories of the Puerto Rican women at the forefront maybe made them feel more connected. And so I wouldn't be fearful of these intimidating stories, but run to the stories of the oppressed and not so much the opposite way around, which is how we hear it in the history books.
There's absolutely no better way I think we could end podcast number one, episode number one, than with those considered remarks. So the challenge is out there. The work, the heavy lifting's been done. The documents have been curated. The questions are out there. All you need to do is print them out and push it out to your classroom and have the discussion. And as Lily said, run towards the hard questions and have the tough discussion and have some faith in these young people that they can handle this, and they can handle it with a tremendous amount of maturity and a tremendous amount of empathy. And hopefully then we become a more empathetic nation going forward. So I want to thank thank Lily again for joining me and for doing this killer lesson here. And wish everybody, hope everybody had a happy St. Patrick's Day. And we'll see you the next time on The Mountain Philosopher.